familiar with the fact that there is a whole group of mitzvahs that only apply in Eretz Yisrael. This is the term that's used by the Mishnah in the mitzvahs Hatzlius Boris, the agricultural mitzvahs. And this, of course, depends on the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah tells us that we have so many mitzvahs. We have the mitzvah of giving to the poor, the leket, shikho, peah, peret, and ololos. We have the mitzvahs to be mafresh, trumas, and maisis, anything that grows in Eretz Yisrael. Fruits, or vegetables, or grain, or debelach, anything that's edible, of course. One is not permitted to eat before they perform the mitzvah of hafroshas, trumas, and maisis. Every seventh year we have the mitzvah of observing Shemitah, and as the years go on, more and more farmers are observing the mitzvah of Shemitah rather than relying on the hetman chir. More and more people are observing the mitzvah of Shemitah, as the Rabbanut is seeing to it that the mitzvahs of hafroshas, trumas, and maisis is being observed in a more proper fashion. In fact, in the newspapers just a year and a half ago, they wrote up the way Yad Eliezer happens to be was involved in further fulfillment of the mitzvah of Maaser Oni. The din requires, there's a 7-year cycle, so the din requires that every year one has to be all the farmers up to be mafresh, trumas, and maisers. So first you take out a little bit for truma v'dova, then you have to take out 10% of what's left for Maaser Rishon, and you're supposed to give it to Levim. Then you're supposed to take out 10% of what's left after that and do something with that. So what exactly are you supposed to do with that? So year number 1 and 2, as well as year number 4 and 5 of the Shemitah cycle, he's supposed to designate the next 10% as Maaser Sheni, which is supposed to be brought to Yerushalayim and eaten. Now we don't have the ability to eat the Maaser Sheni in Yerushalayim for various reasons, for different reasons, quite a few reasons. So therefore we are poted the Maaser Sheni. So everybody who ever visited Eretz Yisrael is familiar with that. You poted the Maaser Sheni, you save the coin, and then you have to destroy the coin before the Pesach of the 4th year, before the Pesach of the 7th year. But then on the 3rd year and the 6th year, instead of being mafresh Maaser Sheni, you're supposed to put aside, supposed to set aside Maaser Oni, supposed to give it to the poor people. So the Maaser, for many years, even the most religious farmers in Eretz Yisrael would designate on the 3rd year and on the 6th year, they would designate the Maaser, the second Maaser, after being mafresh Maaser Rishon, they would designate Maaser Oni, and they wouldn't give it to the Ani, they would take it back. When you designate the Maaser Rishon for the Levim, even if you keep it for yourself, the Yisa Tevel is removed. When you designate, when you curse Hashem on the Maaser Oni and the Maaser Sheni, even if you keep it for yourself, the Yisa of Tevel is taken off from the rest of the Paris. So the Maaser Oni never reached the hands of the Aniim. So just I think a year and a half ago they wrote up in the American newspapers, and they carried it from the Israeli newspapers, that the Rabbana made an arrangement with the Rabbana from the Rabbanut and from the Badats and so on, they made an arrangement with Yad Eliezer that they, all the religious farmers, should give them the Maaser Oni. And some of it they'll distribute to the poor, and others they were buying from the poor and distributing money instead. And it came out to several hundred thousand dollars more for Aniyim, because they actually fulfilled the mitzvah of Maaser Oni. So as the years go on, look, it takes a while till we figure out what's going on with these mitzvahs and Eretz Yisrael. So as the years go on, more and more people are observing the mitzvah of Shemitah when it comes to the 7th year of the Shemitah cycle, and more people are properly observing the other mitzvahs, hatliyas boaretz, of hafroshas, trumas, and maisus. Of course, there is one aspect of the Shemitah year, this is the Shemitah year, of course, there is one aspect of the Shemitah year that applies even outside of Eretz Yisrael, and that's the din of Shemitah Tzofim, that if you loan money to somebody else, and Shemitah comes to a close at the end of the Shemitah year, after this coming Rosh Hashanah, Habolein Eletoiva, so you're not permitted to ask for your money back unless you have arranged to make a proposal in advance. So the Mishnah points out that aspect of the Shemitah's Tzofim, with the need to fill out a proposal, that applies all over the world, even outside of Eretz Yisrael. So this aspect of Eretz Yisrael is the most famous inyan, namely that Eretz Yisrael is the location, the one place in the world which has Kedusha. And because of the Kedusha, sanctity, holiness is not an abstract concept. What it means is that when you say a Sefer Torah has Kedusha, you say that Beis HaMikdash has Kedusha, you say that a Kohen has Kedusha, a lady has more Kedusha than anybody else. So what you mean to say is that we have certain mitzvahs. Sefer Tefillin has Kedusha. What you mean to say is that there are certain mitzvahs that are connected with this person, a place, a time. Shabbos has Kedusha, Yom Tov has Kedusha. What you mean to say is that there are more mitzvahs that apply here than anywhere else. And when you say that Eretz Yisrael is the place that has Kedusha, Eretz Yisrael Kodesh is Mikol Haratzis, What we mean to say is that the mitzvahs are kli dvaris, the agricultural mitzvahs, only apply in Eretz Yisrael and don't apply in the rest of the world. But aside from this famous, the most famous aspect of Eretz Yisrael, namely that is the Mokam HaMekudosh, which is Mechai because of the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, it requires of us to perform certain mitzvahs which don't apply in the rest of the world. We have several other inyanim with respect to Eretz Yisrael that people sometimes are not fully aware of. And I'd like to dwell a little bit more about those inyanim. So one of the inyanim is the following. In Chumash Bereishis, when we read the way the brothers are shuttling back and forth between Mitzrayim when there's a famine, and the rest of the Middle East at that time, and the only country where they have any food is Mitzrayim, because Yosef interpreted the dreams of Paro, and he set aside all the food, and they have storage houses full of food, and he's selling food to the whole area. So it says the brothers were traveling back and forth from Eretz Canaan to Eretz Mitzrayim, and then traveling back with the food after they purchased the food, they traveled back from Mitzrayim to Eretz Canaan. So the expression used by the Chumash is, when they're leaving Eretz Yisrael to go to Egypt, it says, Vayerdu. They were Yardim, they went down. And when they went back from Mitzrayim, Eretz Yisrael, it says, Vayalu, Acha Yosef. Why do we call this Aliyah? And in modern Hebrew, we also call it. When somebody goes to live in Eretz Yisrael, we call that Aliyah. He's an Oleh. And when someone leaves Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutzlos, we call that a Yorei. Why do we call this Aliyah and call that Yorei? So the Talmud points out, based on these psukim, based on other psukim in Tanakh, Eretz Yisrael, Gevoham, we call her Arotis. Eretz Yisrael is higher than the rest of the world. Then you have a pasuk in Chumash Dvarim that says that whenever the Rabbanim will not be able to figure out what the Psak is, there's a machlokes, a dispute among the Rabbanim, and they can't be zalva halachic issue. So the Torah gives them an advice, let them go to the Sanhedrin, the chief Supreme Court, the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, the Kamtav Yalisu El HaMotim, they should go up. From the rest of Eretz Yisrael, they should go up to Yerushalayim. Why do you consider that going up to Yerushalayim? So the rabbis of the Talmud point out that Yerushalayim gavoah mikol Eretz Yisrael. Yerushalayim is taller, a higher location than the rest of Eretz Yisrael. And the question begs itself in the commentaries on the Gemara, ask it, is that really true? That Eretz Yisrael is the highest location above sea level than the rest of the world? The Swiss Alps are much higher. There are mountains in America that are higher than Eretz Yisrael also. So what kind of a statement is that? Eretz Yisrael gevoah mikol ha'aretz, and Yerushalayim is gevoah mikol Eretz Yisrael. The rabbis really thought that Yerushalayim is the highest location above sea level than the rest of Eretz Yisrael. The rabbis of the Talmud say not so. The Talmud discusses that when David HaMelech was considering building the Beis HaMikdash, until the prophet Nosson told him that he's not allowed to because he was a warrior and he killed so many people. He killed, it was a mitzvah, he was killing Arab terrorists, he did a mitzvah, but still, he wasn't a man of peace, and the Beis HaMikdash has to be a Malkam Shalom, so he's going to have a son Shlomo, who will be a man of peace, and his son will build the Beis HaMikdash. But originally David was planning to build the Beis HaMikdash, and whenever the Psukim say, whenever he conquered the territory from the enemy, whenever he conquered whatever he won in war, so whenever he would win precious metals, gold, silver, whatever, he would always designate everything towards the Beis HaMikdash. The Psukim and the Rayamim say that. So he was preparing to build the Beis HaMikdash. So the Talmud records that his plan was originally to build the Beis HaMikdash in the location that had the highest elevation above sea level in Eretz Yisrael, which was not Yerushalayim. The Talmud tells you the name of the place is Einikin. It's outside of Yerushalayim, it's in the outskirts of Yerushalayim, but it's not inside Yerushalayim. So the rabbis of the Talmud knew that Yerushalayim is not the highest location in Eretz Yisrael. So what do they mean when they make a statement that Yerushalayim is the highest location in Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael is Gevoah Mikol HaAretz, is higher than the rest of the world? So the commentaries on the Talmud point out that what this means is the following. We know the earth is a globe. Whenever you have a globe, you have two hemispheres. That's obvious. Every globe has two hemispheres. A little ball has two hemispheres. So you can divide your two hemispheres however you want. So you can have an upper hemisphere and a lower hemisphere that's divided at the equator. Or you can have an eastern hemisphere and a western hemisphere divided politically, with the United States on the western hemisphere and the enemies on the eastern hemisphere. However you want, you can divide it. So the rabbis of the Talmud understood that the Tanakh is dividing the world into two hemispheres. The upper hemisphere and the lower hemisphere, not by the equator, but rather the other way. And we hold Eretz, you can hold whatever, when you have a ball, you can hold whatever you want on top. If you want, you can take the globe and hold the South Pole on top. If you want, you can hold New York City on top. You can hold whatever you want. How it's going to rotate on exact axis, that's a different story. Where the axis is and how this globe is rotating is a different mice. But we're saying, how are you supposed to hold the globe? What's the difference how you hold the globe? So the rabbis of the Talmud say, no, that you have the world as a globe, and Yerushalayim is Gevoah in the Kol Eretz Yisrael. It's the highest location on top of the globe. And Eretz Yisrael is the highest location. You put it on top of the globe. You can rig it, you can hold the globe however you want. So what's the significance if you can rig it? What's the difference? What do you say? You can may as well say Be'er Sheva is on top of the globe. You can say South Africa is, you can put whatever you want on top of the globe. So the rabbis of the Talmud understand that it's relevant with respect to the issue of the international dateline. Everybody understands that we today know, we send our children to learn Eretz Yisrael. Some people have grandchildren living in Eretz Yisrael. So we know that in Eretz Yisrael, Shabbos begins 7 hours earlier and ends 7 hours earlier. We go to California from time to time, so it's not a secret. We know that in California, Shabbos begins 3 hours later than in the East Coast and ends 3 hours later. And the further west you go, so the later Shabbos begins. And the further east you go, so the earlier Shabbos begins. So the question is, if you have two people, one person is going east and one person is going west, he's going to keep on beginning to accept Shabbos earlier, earlier, earlier. And the one who's going to the west is going to begin Shabbos later, later, later. These two people are going to bump into each other. So what's going to be over here? On the other side of the globe, the fellow who's traveling east, he will be beginning Shabbos, let's say, 15 hours earlier than we in New York. And the one who's going west is going to begin Shabbos 15 hours later. So they're going to have two different days for Shabbos. So that's why the nations of the world realize that you have to have a cutoff point that you call the international dateline. That Atkan, all the beginning of time begins over here. So the question is, where is that international dateline? So the nations of the world have decided, just to make life easier for all of mankind, to draw an international dateline in the middle of the Pacific Ocean where it won't bother anybody, where it doesn't cut through any landmass. The Maisa does cut through landmass, so they rigged it. So they have the dateline goes around Manchuria, it goes around Asia, then it goes around a couple of islands in the Pacific. It doesn't exactly go straight. It's a little bit, when you look at a map, it's a little bit crooked. So do the rabbis accept the Haskamas Umas Olam? Do we accept the international dateline that was made up by the nations of the world? So the Pashto says there should be a halacha about this. This is a halachic issue. When does Shabbos begin? When does Yantar begin? Where is the beginning of all of time? So the Talmud does discuss it, and the Talmud says that halachically the international dateline is not where the nations of the world have placed it arbitrarily. It wasn't really arbitrarily, but it's for convenience sake that they drew this line, this imaginary line in the middle of the Pacific Ocean where it won't bother anybody. But rather the rabbis of the Talmud understood that you're supposed to hold the globe in such a way that Eretz Yisrael is on top and Yerushalayim is on top of on top. That's what it means. Doesn't mean Yerushalayim has the highest location above sea level in Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael is the highest location above sea level from all the countries of the world. They knew that the Swiss Alps were higher. What they meant to say was that you're supposed to hold your globe in such a way, your upper hemisphere where all of civilization began, the cradle of civilization was over there somewhere where Adam Rishon was in Gan Eden, somewhere in Africa. So you're supposed to hold Yerushalayim right on top. So if you hold Yerushalayim right on top, so you have 6 hours to the right, is the beginning of all of time. That's where the international dateline is halachically. That's the position of the Chazon Ish and many, many poskim who follow his view. That's what he points out, it says in the Talmud. And that's why the Chazon Ish's position was that the dateline cuts through Korea. And it cuts through Australia. So then you have a problem. So what do you mean? On one side of the street is Erev Shabbos, the other side of the street is Shabbos. So these details he works out already in his Sefer. He quotes the Rishonim, the commentaries on the Talmud, who think that that doesn't make any sense to say on one side, if it's one big landmass, to say that on one side of the street is Erev Shabbos, one side of the street is Shabbos, that doesn't make sense. So he works out the details, which part of the landmass should be following which. But that's the meaning of the passage in the Talmud. Eretz Yisrael has significance not only because of the fact that it has Kedusha, and because of its Kedusha, we are obligated to observe all of these special mitzvahs, at least words, the agricultural mitzvahs. It also has significance in the fact that that's supposed to be the center of the upper hemisphere, which is relevant with respect to the issue of the international dateline. Another point which is sometimes forgotten regarding the significance of Eretz Yisrael is the ownership of Eretz Yisrael. Who is the balabas? Who owns Eretz Yisrael? Who does it belong to? So the Psukim in Bereishis tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu to walk around the borders of the land, Kum Hisalech Ba'aretz Le'orko Ulerachba, to walk around the borders of Eretz Yisrael, Ki Lecho Etinena, because I will give you Eretz Yisrael. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised to Yitzchak and to Yaakov that he will see to it that the promise that he made to Avraham Avinu will be fulfilled by their children, by their descendants. How do you translate the words in the pasuk Ki Lecho Etinena? Because I will give you Eretz Yisrael in the future, sometime in the distant future, when Yeshua ben Nun will cross over the Jordan and he will take his soldiers and conquer the land. That's when that promise to Avraham Avinu was fulfilled. Ki Lecho Etinena. Or does it mean, walk around, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, walk around the borders of Eretz Yisrael, because right now, as you walk around, you will acquire ownership, it'll belong to you right now. It doesn't mean future, distant future, and in a few centuries, in the days of Yeshua ben Nun, when the Jews will conquer Eretz Yisrael from the 31 kings, from the Lamed Aleph Melachim, but it rather means that right now, by walking around Eretz Yisrael, you will acquire ownership of Eretz Yisrael. So the rabbis of the Talmud point out that Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't know pshat in the pasuk. And when Moshe Rabbeinu delivered the prophecy to the Jewish people before Yetzias Mitzrayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, "V'hotzeisi, v'hitzalti, v'gaalti, v'lakachti, v'heveisi eschem el ha'aretz," I will bring you to Eretz Yisrael, "v'nasati osa," before Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then Moshe Rabbeinu concluded the prophecy, "V'nasati osa lachem morosho," and I will give you Eretz Yisrael as a morosho. Is a difficult word. What does that mean? Does it mean the same as a Yerusha? A Yerusha we know. A Yerusha means an inheritance from the days of Avraham Avinu. When Avraham Avinu walked around the border of Eretz Yisrael, he acquired ownership and it was his. And the descendants of Avraham Avinu and Yitzchak and Yaakov all got Eretz Yisrael as a Yerusha. So that's what the word Morosho means, a Yerusha. Or maybe it doesn't mean a Yerusha. Maybe it didn't belong to them yet until the days of Yeshua ben Nun. So Moshe Rabbeinu delivered this prophecy to the Bnei Yisrael. He himself didn't know what the word meant. The rabbis of the Talmud had a tradition regarding the story of the Bnei Tzolofkot. The Torah tells us that during the 40 years of travel in the desert, there was an individual, a man by the name of Tzolofkot, who had several daughters. He had no sons. And when he passed away, his daughters came to request of Moshe Rabbeinu a chelik in the Yerusha in Eretz Yisrael. So what was the shaila? And it says Moshe Rabbeinu was dumbfounded. He didn't know the din. What did he not know the din? He didn't know the halacha that the daughters get Yerusha when there are no sons. So the rabbis of the Talmud say Moshe Rabbeinu knew that din, and the Bnei Tzolofkot knew that din also. Today, some people present it as if Bnei Tzolofkot represented women's rights, and they pressured Moshe Rabbeinu long enough, or they pressured the Rabban Shalom long enough, however version you'll say, until they gave in, until the good rabbi Moshe Rabbeinu gave in, until the Rabban Shalom gave in, and he gave the women their rights. So the rabbis of the Talmud did not understand it like that. Rabbis of the Talmud have the following understanding, that the daughters of Tzolofkot knew that din, that when there are sons and daughters, the sons get Yerusha and the daughters don't get. And when there are no sons, then the daughters get Yerusha. They knew. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that din, and Bnei Tzolofkot knew that din. The issue that was under question was a totally different issue, not whether women get Yerusha. The question was, Tzolofkot ben Hefer, their father who had died, was the Bchor. He was the firstborn to his father. That's what it says in the Tanakh. And the din says that the firstborn is entitled to a double shear, a double portion, pishnayim. It means if there are two sons, they treat the Bchor as if he himself is two. So instead of dividing the Yerusha into two parts, 50-50, you divide it into three parts and the Bchor gets two-thirds. Let's say if there are 10 sons, so instead of, and one of them is a Bchor, so instead of dividing the Yerusha into 10 parts and everybody getting one-tenth, you divide it into 11 parts, and you treat the Bchor as if he were two sons, he gets 2/11. It doesn't mean he always gets two-thirds. If there are two sons, then he gets two-thirds. If there are 4 sons, instead of dividing into 4 parts, you divide it to 5, and he gets 2/5. However many sons there are, you treat the Bchor as if he were 2 sons. He gets a double portion. But this halacha that the Bchor is entitled to a double portion, pishnayim, only applies, it says in the Chumash like that, it only applies b'muchzok and not b'ro. It means whatever, b'chol ha'she'i motzi lo. The Bchor is entitled to a double portion in whatever the father possesses at the time of death. What if the father bought a lottery ticket, and after the father dies, then they have the drawing, and the father's number, the father's ticket wins after he dies. So the Mishnah says that the Pchor does not get Pishnayim, he doesn't get a double portion, and that in the $1 billion that he won on the lottery ticket, on the New York State lottery ticket, the Pchor will not get Pishnayim. If the winning number won before the father died, let's say he was sick in the hospital for a couple of weeks till he finally died, he was in a coma, but he's still alive. So when he gets, if his number won while he was still alive, then the Pchor is entitled to Pishnayim on that also. But if he won the money after his death, then the Pchor does not get Pishnayim. So the question that the rabbi said, the question that the Benoit Salofchot came to ask, was a very learned question, not stam a question of ignorance. Do the daughters get Yerusha when there are no sons? That they knew the answer to, that Moshe Rabbeinu knew the answer to. The tradition has it that they were asking regarding the share in Eretz Yisrael. Their father, Tzolofchad, was entitled to a double portion in his father's Yerusha, Tzolofchad ben Hefer. The question is, what did they have already? They were traveling in the desert. What did they have? A valise full of shmachtas. What do they have? Pajamas, slippers, a pair of shoes, shmachta bathrobe. What could they possibly have already? When they were traveling in the Midbar, what do they have? So the main thing that they had was the real estate in Eretz Yisrael. That's worth a lot of money. So the shaila was, did Chefer, the grandfather, already have ownership in his share in Eretz Yisrael while he was alive? So his son Tzlofchad should be entitled to a double portion, and then the daughters of Tzlofchad should get a lot of real estate. They should divide the real estate. Or did he say, no, that was only promised to Avraham Avinu. Ki l'choy tinenu, walk around the borders of Eretz Yisrael, and I promise you, in the distant future, when Yeshua ben Nun will conquer the land, then you'll get ownership of Eretz Yisrael. But Tozman, that they didn't cross over the Yarden yet, it's like the lottery ticket that didn't win yet. It's just a promise, but they didn't get it yet. So the Talmud has a tradition that that was the question that the Bnei Salofchad asked of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he himself didn't know. He said he didn't know what pshat. Moshe Rabbeinu said he does know what pshat was. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu, Ki l'choy tinenu, in the future, doesn't mean the distant future, doesn't mean the immediate future. By walking around the borders, he hereby acquires ownership of Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't mean when Yeshua ben Nun will conquer the land, they will acquire ownership. And Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't sure when he himself delivered the prophecy, before Yetzias Mitzrayim, and he said, V'nasati osalachem, mor asho, ani Hashem, I will give you Eretz Yisrael as a mor asho. He said he's not sure himself what he meant. What did the Baruch Shalom mean, Morasha? Does it mean an alta Yerusha from the days of Avraham Avinu? Or it means Morasha, a promise that they're going to get something, but they didn't get it yet. And it's a difference regarding the Chelek and Eretz Yisrael. So the answer was given by Kodesh Baruch Hu, yes, Nason Titein. Where did the rabbis get this whole interpretation? Where does it say that in the Chumash? The simple reading of the Chumash is that the Menai Tzolofchad were asking whether daughters are entitled to Yerusha. So the rabbis understood this because the Pasuk has a double lashon. Noson titein lahem nachalah. Noson titein, the double expression means, yes, they get a double portion, just like a b'chor. Every other b'chor is entitled to a double shear. So the Benoit Tzolofchad are entitled to represent their father Tzolofchad in getting a double shear in Chefer's Yerusha. Why? Because Eretz Yisrael machzakasim mi'abisenu, mi'mois Avraham Avinu. Eretz Yisrael belonged to the Jewish people, not from the time that they crossed over the Jordan in the days of Yeshua ben Nun and they conquered Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael belonged to the Jewish people from the time that Avraham Avinu walked around the borders. The walking around the borders constituted the Kinyan. That was considered the Kinyan Chazoket. And in fact, the Talmud in Bava Basra and Daf Kuf has a dispute among the Tanoim. What would it then be today? What if I want to sell you a field? And I tell you, make a Kinyan Chazaka. So one normal way to make a Kinyan Chazaka is to put up a fence around the whole field, or to put a lock on the door, or to lock the door. There is a lock. To lock the door, to open the door. Different forms of Chazaka. Would this constitute a valid form of Kinyan Chazaka? If I say, stroll around the borders of the area, and by your walking around the borders, you should acquire ownership. So there's a dispute among the Tanaim. So Rav Lezer's opinion is yes, just like it was a Kenyan for Avraham Avinu, it's a Kenyan today as well. And the Talmud says we don't accept Rav Lezer's opinion. We assume that that was only a Kenyan as a Hayru Ashur. That was only one time in the history of the world. God told Avraham Avinu, by your walking around, this will constitute a Kenyan, and Eretz Yisrael will be acquired to you and to your descendants immediately by your walking around. But it doesn't apply in any other situation. This is the tradition that the rabbis of the Talmud have, that Eretz Yisrael began to belong to the Jewish people from the days of Avraham Avinu on. And we never lost our ownership. When the Psukim tell us in Bereishis that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised Yitzchak Avinu, and he promised Yankov Avinu, that Eretz Yisrael will belong to their descendants, what do you mean that he promised? Let's say, Moshe L'mad Avadam, let's say if I came to a chasana, and I forgot to bring a matana. So at the end of the chasana, I wish the mechutoni, mazal tov, beautiful wedding, you have a lot of nachas, smaller children, and I tell the chasana kal, I forgot to bring the gift, I'll give it next week. So I come to the Sheva Brachas next week, Vaita. At the end of the show, I forgot to bring the gift. So I promise him, I'm going to give you the gift. Then a year goes by, they already have a bris, and I figure out then, I keep on forgetting to give the chasana matana. So I keep on promising, then I come to the bar mitzvah, to the chasana, yeah. I keep on promising, so if I keep on promising, because I didn't give it yet, what if I gave it already? I gave them matana already, so I have to keep on promising them that I'm going to give them matana. I gave them matana. So why does God keep on promising Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak Avinu, Yaakov Avinu, he's going to give Eretz Yisrael to the Jewish people? What do you mean he's going to give? He gave already. When Avraham Avinu walked around the borders, according to our tradition, that was it. That was the kinyan. He already gave Eretz Yisrael to the Jewish people. So why was it necessary? What is the meaning of the promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps on making a haftoche, in a bris, in a shvuah, that Eretz Yisrael will belong to the Jewish people? So the Chazon Ish and many others, that's what Rav Soloveitchik used to say also, they all point out, what it means is the following. Unlike all other property that any individual or nation may possibly possess, Eretz Yisrael is different. It is not subject to the principle, the international law of Kibush Milchama. There is a principle which the Talmud develops in the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara quotes Psukim from Tanakh to demonstrate this principle. If one country wages war against another country, whether it was beheter or beisa, whether it was in self-defense, or whether it was outright robbery, if one country wages war against another country, the country that wins the war acquires ownership of all of the people and all the property, all the real estate, and all the automobiles, and all the bicycles, and all the furniture. Everything belongs to the winning country, whether they had the right to or they had no right to. It doesn't matter. The koina, if they gazlon him, the other country has the right to fight back, to retrieve their property. But that's the halacha. There's a principle of Kibush Milchama. The Talmud points out that this principle applies whether it's Jews waging war against non-Jews, non-Jews waging war against Jews, or one non-Jewish nation waging war against another non-Jewish nation. The rabbis couldn't visualize a civil war that the Jews fighting against the Jews, that even though in Tanakh you have, they don't speak about that possibility. Jews waging war against Jews. They just speak about the other three possibilities. The non-Jewish, one non-Jewish country waging war against another non-Jewish country, or Jews waging war against non-Jews, or non-Jews winning against Jews. Whoever wins the war acquires ownership. So the rabbis of the Talmud understood that the one exception to the rule, that the country that wins the war acquires ownership of all of the property, the one exception to the rule is Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was given to Avraham Avinu as a matona, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, Eretz Yisrael will always belong to the Jewish people. The ownership will never be lost. So even when the first temple was destroyed and Eretz Yisrael was taken over by the Babylonian armies, it did not belong to the nation of Babel. And even when the second temple was built, and it wasn't under, Eretz Yisrael was not under Jewish control, it was under the control of the Persian king till the days of the Hashemarim. And then after the destruction of the second temple, the Romans took over Eretz Yisrael. The Jewish people never lost their ownership. Eretz Yisrael belonged to the Jewish people from the beginning, Ad HaYom HaZeh, from the days of Avraham Avinu. We didn't lose our ownership of Eretz Yisrael at the time of the destruction of the first temple, nor did we lose our ownership of Eretz Yisrael at the time of the destruction of the second temple. There were Gazlanim who were living there in Eretz Yisrael, but all along it belonged to the Jewish people. And the right of the Jewish people to return in 1948 and to establish the Medina had nothing to do with the Balfour Declaration. Politically, it had to do with the Balfour Declaration, with the League of Nations, with the United Nations, the partition plan, and all of that. That's all of history. But halachically, all of this was irrelevant. Eretz Yisrael belonged to the Jewish people from day number one, and we never lost our ownership. From the days of Avraham Avinu, Ad HaYom HaZeh. I remember once on one occasion in the yeshiva we had a guest. Whenever there would be Rabbanim, big Rabbanim would visit from Eretz Yisrael, so they would be invited either to give a shiur in Rav Soloveitchik's class or in the Beis HaMedrash. Sometimes the chief rabbis would speak, sometimes even not the lesser, less dignitaries, other Rabbanim would speak. So on one occasion, Rabbi Soloveitchik was learning Sanhedrin. We had a prominent rabbi, a Talmid Chacham from Eretz Yisrael, visited, and Rabbi Soloveitchik invited him to give a shiur. In the middle of his shiur that he gave in Rabbi Soloveitchik's classroom, see, he developed an idea that during the 70 years of Golus Bavel, the Jewish people lost their ownership of Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was very upset, and he disagreed with him right away. He said, it's not true. But he said that's his tradition. That's what he understood, and he continued to interpret a difficult passage in the Rama based on that premise. So the next day, before Rabbi Soloveitchik started his regular shiur, this rabbi had already left, so he repeated again. He doesn't agree with anything that he said yesterday. And he quoted the passage in the Talmud, that when a Talmud Chacham makes a mistake, you have to put him in his place and make it clear that you don't agree. So he said he wants it to be clear that he doesn't agree with what he said. He agreed with the Chazon Ish and the majority of the posting, that the ownership of Eretz Yisrael always belonged to the Jewish people from the days of Avraham Avinu ad Hayom Hazeh. That's exactly what it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu already gave Eretz Yisrael to Avraham Avinu, and then he kept on making a bris, a covenant, and a haptocha, a promise, and a shvua, an oath to Yitzchok and to Yaakov, that Eretz Yisrael will always belong to the Jewish people. And that's exactly the difference between the word Yerusha and the word Morasha. Yerusha means you get a big Yerusha, the rich uncle dies, and I get $500,000, and I can do whatever I want with the money. I can stuff it into my mattress, I can put it into the CD account in the bank, I can distribute it to charity, I can burn the money, I can do whatever I want. That's an inheritance. And then a heritage is a different thing. A heritage means a family heirloom, something that I got an inheritance on, and it's my responsibility to transmit it in its entirety to the next generation. So Eretz Yisrael is a morasha, not only a Yerusha. Yerusha means an inheritance that the Yorish has a right to do whatever he don't pleases. And the morasha means a heritage where you have to transmit it in its entirety to the next generation. There is yet another aspect to Eretz Yisrael, unrelated to the fact that Eretz Yisrael has Kiddusha, and also unrelated to the fact that Eretz Yisrael is the center of the globe, and unrelated to the fact that Eretz Yisrael belongs to the Jewish people, it is the ownership of the Jewish people. We have halachas, we have dinim, which are not agricultural dinim, have nothing to do with farmers or agriculture, that only apply in Eretz Yisrael. Take for example, smicha can only be conferred in Eretz Yisrael. Why? What does it have to do with the farmers? What, the farmers are getting smicha? Not too many farmers are applying for smicha. What kind of a din is that? So the Rambam, this appears in the Mishnah in Bukharis, on Daf Chav Tes. So the Rambam, in his commentary on Mishnayis, wants to explain that din. You see, we had yeshivas in America, they had yeshivas in Europe, where they conferred smicha. So the Talmud points out that's only imitation smicha. The real bona fide smicha we no longer have, because the real smicha has to be conferred only in Eretz Yisrael, Ish mipi Ish ad Moshe Rabbeinu. And the real smicha was discontinued already in the early days of the Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael. All the Amoraim in Bavel, when we study Gemara, they called Rav Huna and Rav Yirmiyah. That's reverend. You know, they didn't say that rabbi and a reverend. Rabbi means a real rabbi, and a reverend means an imitation rabbi. So all the rabbis in Bavel are called Rav. That means a reverend, not a real rabbi. The Amoraim, the early Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael are called Rebbe Zera, Rebbe Ami, Rebbe Yasi. Rebbe means that they got real smicha. So a few generations of Amoraim, they still maintain smicha. And then after a couple of years, they discontinued all the smicha because of the persecutions. The goyim are making such persecutions, so they simply wouldn't allow them to confer smicha. So that was the end. The real smicha ended a long time ago, around the year 300 or so. So now we only have imitation smicha. So the Rambam, in his commentary on Mishnayis and Chorus and Daf Kotes, tries to explain why should this be so? Why should the halacha learn that from Sukkim and Chumash? Right? Why should there be such a halacha that one can only confer the real bona fide smicha in Eretz Yisrael? So the Rambam quotes, to explain this, a passage in the Talmud and Hayrius that says as follows. There is a din in Chumash Vayikra that we read before Pesach and Parshas Vayikra and Parshas Tzav. If by mistake somebody was Mechalal Shabbos, B'shogei, he is required to bring a Korban Chatos in the Beis HaMikdash. Today we have no Beis HaMikdash, but the din says that a person should keep track, a person should keep a record of how many times he mistakenly was Mechal Shabbos, so that when the Beis HaMikdash will be built, we should know how many Korbanos Chatos we have to bring. Well, let's say a woman gives birth to a baby, that's this week's Kriya, Parshas Tazria. So the Torah requires that the woman should bring a set of korbanos. And if a woman has 9 babies, my wife, we were blessed with 9 babies, so that when the Beis HaMikdash will be built, and my wife will, we should be zeichet to build the Beis HaMikdash, and my wife will have to bring 9 sets of korbanos. So the Chumash has the following din. What if it's the Kohen Gadol who is Mechal Shabbos B'Shogeg? He has to bring a different korban, different kind of achatos. And what if it's the Melech? What if it's the king who is Mechal Shabbos B'Shogeg? He has to bring a different kind of a korban. And what if all of Klal Yisrael was Mechal Shabbos? How can it be that all of Klal Yisrael is Mechal Shabbos? What does that mean? So the Talmud explains in Mishnah's Harias what it means is the following. The Bez Nagadol gave a psak that you're allowed to turn on lights on Shabbos. Sure. There was some rabbanim who thought originally when they started when they first came out with electric lights. So some rabbanim thought that it's permissible to turn on lights on Shabbos. So let's say the chief Supreme Court, the Bez Nagadol and Herzog, will pass them that it's permissible to turn on lights. Right? So everybody will turn on lights. And then 20 years later, 30 years later, or 5 years later, they'll change their mind. Or maybe they won't even change their mind. There'll be different people in the Bez Nagadol. 30 years later, there'll be a whole different composition of Rabbanim in the Bez Nagadol, and they will change the mind of the Supreme Court. And they will pass them that it constitutes a biblical prohibition to turn on lights on Shabbos. So from now on, you're not supposed to turn on the lights. Okay, so what's going to be with all the people who are Mechal Shabbos? It was the fault of the Bez Nagadol. So the Chumash speaks of a special carbon, Par Helam Novishel Tzibur. If more than 50% of the Jewish community was Mechal Shabbos, Eret Chelev, Adam, Eret Chametz B'Pesach, Eret Anyam Kippur, and Aver that would have a punishment of Kares, so if they violated this Aver B'Shogeg, and it wasn't really their fault, it was the fault of the Psak of the Bez Nagadol. That's what the Rabbanim Paskin, the chief rabbi of the Eretz Yisrael, Paskin, that is permissible. So then the Torah has a special carbon that the Bez Nagadol brings, Achatos Parham Del Shal Tzibur, and everybody gets a kapara. All the people who are Mechal Shabbos get a kapara with that one carbon, and it's not necessary for each and every individual person to bring his own carbon. So the Talmud points out when you're calculating, when you're taking the vote to determine whether more than 50% or less than 50% of the Jewish population violated this Aveira, so the rabbis of the Talmud point out based on Psukim in Tanakh that you only include in the count the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. You don't take into consideration the Jews who live in America, even though the majority of the world Jewish population does not live in Eretz Yisrael today. The majority of the world Jewish population lives outside of Eretz Yisrael still. The Gemara says, the Hayro, when it comes to the Psak of the Bez Nagadol, and the calculation to determine whether more or less than 50% of the Jewish population violated the Avera, Halocha HaYoshvei Eretz Yisrael. You only take into consideration those who live in Eretz Yisrael. Why is this so? So the Rambam understands this passage in the Talmud to mean that only those who live in Eretz Yisrael constitute Klal Yisrael. Those who live in Chutz Lorets, they're also Jewish, card-carrying members, but they don't have voting rights. They're not full-fledged members of Klal Yisrael. The Iker Siruf of Klal Yisrael refers to those Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. Ben Gurion used to say something like that. He used to say, only the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael are Jewish. The Jews who live in Chutz Lorets are not Jewish. So that's a thought. That's certainly not correct. I mean, we don't have to keep Kashrus Shabbos. We don't have to keep any mitzvahs. That's not correct. The Jews and Chutz Lorets are Jewish also. But you're not considered a member of Klal Yisrael. The mitzaref of Klal Yisrael is those who live in Eretz Yisrael. They have to be Maminim also. It's questionable whether he lived in Eretz Yisrael. He was a big man in Eretz Yisrael. It's questionable whether he was a member of Klal Yisrael, even though he lived in Eretz Yisrael. No. The Bez Shalmaila will decide that question. A different story. You have to be a religious person to be considered part of the Klal Yisrael. The Jews who are not observant, who are not Maminim, they're Jewish, but they're also not part of the Klal Yisrael. So the Rambam quotes that passage in the Talmud, that institution of Par Helam Dovashal Tzibur, this special carbon is brought if more than 50% of the Klal Yisrael violated an Aveira based on the Psak of the Bez Nagadol, that you only bring one special carbon. So the Rambam quotes the Gemara that you only keep in mind, you only tally the count with respect to those who live in Eretz Yisrael. The Jews who live in Chutz Lorets don't count because they're not part of Klal Yisrael. So the Rambam explains in his commentary on the Mishnah is that that's exactly the reason why the smicha can only be conferred in Eretz Yisrael. Conferring smicha, the Rambam understands, is not a private matter. that each Rebbe who has his own smicha can confer smicha to his students. No. The Talmud points out that when they used to confer smicha, it used to be done in a public fashion. They used to have like the yeshivas have today. They make a chag smicha every couple of years in Yeshiva University. Now that the yeshivas, they make a chag smicha in Lublini Yeshiva. A Meryl Shapira had in Lublini Yeshiva. They also had a chag smicha that was written up in all the Yiddish newspapers in Europe. Made a big public tararam about the fact that it was conferring smicha, and it wasn't just a fundraising gimmick. It may or may not have been a fundraising gimmick as well, but Al-Pidin, Halacha says when you confer real smicha, it has to be conferred in public, because the smicha is not a private thing that every Rebbe who happens to have smicha has the right to transmit the smicha to the students. The smicha is given the shame Kol Yisrael. It's considered as if all of Klal Yisrael is conferring the smicha on a new ordained candidate. So that's what the Rambam explains. That's why smicha has to be only given in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutz La'aretz, because the mitzaref of Klal Yisrael, the tziruf of Klal Yisrael, only applies in Eretz Yisrael. And the Rambam writes the same in his Sefer HaMitzvos as well. The Rambam writes the following interesting point, that years ago, how did they determine when Rosh Chodesh was? Any given month can have either 29 days or 30 days. So they would, the Beis Din would wait. There would be a Beis Din was designated by the Supreme Court, by the Beis Din Gadol. A Beis Din of three would be chosen. Beis Din Gadol had 71 members, so they would choose a small Beis Din of three who would sit in a certain location, and everybody would know. And they would wait till witnesses would come and testify that they saw the new moon. And based on when the witnesses would show up, the Beis Din would determine whether any given month had 29 days or 30 days, whether Rosh Chodesh should be on the 30th day or the 31st day. We have an institution of 2 days Rosh Chodesh. That's a complicated story. How can I have two heads? How can be two such a thing as two? That's only Midirabbanan. And I tell you, there is no such thing as 2 days Rosh Chodesh. That's a different story. So the Rambam writes that this was practice. The determination of when Rosh Chodesh should be was practice as long as they had smicha. But then it came a time around the year 300 or so, about that time, and they saw that the institution of smicha is going to disappear because of the persecution from the Goyish government. They kept on pressuring the Jews not to confer any smicha, so they instituted the practice of Kiddush HaChodesh al-Pi HaChesed, that Rosh Chodesh happens by itself, and they printed a luach, and we followed that luach. We don't have to have any bezin declaring when Rosh Chodesh is any longer. So how did we decide yesterday on Shabbos, the Gabbai or the Chazan announced Rosh Chodesh is going to be Monday and Tuesday? Who decided that? What, the local rabbi? Wonderful rabbi, but Rabbi Yudin decided for all the Klal Yisrael? No. Who decided? The Rabbanim in New York City? Also not. Who decided? So we usually assume it was decided 1500 years ago, a long time ago. It was decided when they set up the calendar. We follow that system. So the Rambam writes in his Sefer HaMitzvos that that's not exactly so. He says that we today, when we calculate when Rosh Chodesh is going to be based on the system of the Jewish calendar, we are not relying on our calculations, but rather we follow the practice of the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. The Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael in the days of the Rambam. How many Jews were there? There was no Jewish government. There was barely a minyan. How many Jews were there already living in Eretz Yisrael? What is he referring to? So the Chasam Sofer has an essay where he explains what the Rambam is talking about. The Rambam, and then the Rambam writes, and if Chalila, one could imagine in his mind that there would be no Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, there would be no Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh would cease to exist, and then none of the Yom Tovim would exist. But the Rambam says we have a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Klal Yisrael will never cease to exist. So that's why we know that it's impossible for the whole Jewish Yishuv to disappear in Eretz Yisrael. So that's what the Rambam writes in the Sefer HaMitzvos when he writes the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh. So obviously, the Chasam Sofer points out, obviously the Rambam thinks that the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael are designated as Klal Yisrael. The Jews who live in Chutz La'aretz are Jewish. They have the Kedushas Yisrael. They're obligated to keep mitzvahs, but they're not considered Klal Yisrael. And after the institution of Kiddush HaChodesh al-Pi HaRiyah, after that no longer exists, we no longer have a Beis Din receiving witnesses to testify when they saw the moon, after we no longer have that practice. So Klal Yisrael does the determination of when Rosh Chodesh is, and the Klal Yisrael refers to the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't include the Jews who live in America. It doesn't choose the majority of the Jews who are alive today are not part of Klal Yisrael, because we don't live in Eretz Yisrael. So that's another Indian that's important to keep in mind. That Eretz Yisrael al pi din is the mitzareif of Klal Yisrael. Every nation has to have a national homeland. And this is not Zionist propaganda. This is the Rambam writing. The Rambam wrote this. That there are halachas that depend on Klal Yisrael that are not chayvus hayachid. In fact, Taisus in the beginning of Pesachim writes a famous comment that although we know the practice was during the days of the Temple that many Jews would travel from Europe and Asia and Africa to come to Yerushalayim to participate in Korban Pesach and Erev Pesach, but Taisus says, strictly speaking, if they don't want to, they don't have to. The mitzvah of Korban Pesach is only required of those who live in Eretz Yisrael. So on the bottom of the page, in every Gemara in Pesachim, on Dav Gimel on the base where the Taisus appears, on the bottom of the page they write that the Mishnah on Melech, one of the commentaries on the Rambam says that this Taisus is beyond him, it doesn't make any sense, he thinks that they're wrong. There's no source in the Talmud for this, he doesn't know where in the world Taisus got it from. So the later commentaries point out he's right, it doesn't appear anywhere in the Talmud Bavli, but it does appear in the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi makes such a statement that the obligation to participate in Korban Pesach only applies to the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael, and the reason is given why. Taisus doesn't give any reason, they just make a statement. And the reason is given because Korban Pesach is called a Korban Sibur. It's not a private Korban. Individuals bring Korban Pesach. No, it's considered a Korban Sibur, the Gemara says, because everybody brings it all together, b'chinufya. And when it comes to a matter of Tzibur, only the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael are considered the Tzibur. The Jews who live in Chutz Lorets are not considered part of the Klal Yisrael, they're not considered the Tzibur. It's important to keep this in mind. There's yet another aspect that's today become a very popular aspect of Eretz Yisrael, namely the issue of the Medina, Medinas Yisrael. There is a mitzvah, one of the 613 mitzvahs is that the Jewish people should see to it that we establish a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael that should control all of Eretz Yisrael. This is clearly one of the 613 mitzvahs. Some make a mistake and they think that this is only the opinion of the Ramban. Ramban, both in his commentary on Chumash as well as in his commentary on the Sefer Mitzvahs, points out that we have a pasuk in the end of Chumash Bamidbar where the Torah tells us V'yirishtem Oso, V'yishavtem Bo. The pasuk has two parts to it. V'yirishtem Oso means that the Jewish people has an obligation to take hold politically, to seize control of Eretz Yisrael, and to establish a Jewish government there to control all of Eretz Yisrael. And then number two, the Yishavtem Bo, that we have an obligation all to live in Eretz Yisrael, we're supposed to all live there. And the Ramban and the Sefer HaMitzvahs complains why the Rambam failed to count this mitzvah. So many misunderstood the point of the Ramban. They thought the Rambam doesn't count the mitzvah at all. No. The mitzvah of establishing a Medina, the Rambam does count. That the Gemara says. The Talmud says that to establish a Medina, a Jewish government in ourselves, one of the 613 mitzvahs. That's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and the Rambam quotes that. And the Sefer HaMitzvahs, and he quotes in Yad HaZokah. It's the other half that the Rambam didn't mention. It's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. That's the Pella. So the Ramban asked, why didn't the Rambam mention the mitzvah of Yishev Eretz Yisrael to live in Eretz Yisrael? But the first part, the Rambam does count. A mitzvah to establish a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael, and that Jewish government should have control of all of Eretz Yisrael. Not to allow Eretz Yisrael to be under non-Jewish control. That is one of the 613 mitzvahs. And the halacha declares that Yerushalayim is al pi din the capital of Eretz Yisrael. It's not a political statement of the Israeli government to rub the Arabs the wrong way. It has nothing to do with politics. That's halacha in the Talmud. Yerushalayim al pi din is the capital of Eretz Yisrael. The halacha says that when dividing Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yishur ben Nun, so the Talmud has a discussion in the end of Gemara Sanhedrin. Talmud says it doesn't make sense to draw, they had a divide among the different Shvatim. This is Chelek Shal Reuven, this is Chelek Shimon, every Shevet got a Chelek except Shevet Levi didn't get, they get 48 cities and they got the 6 Ari Miklot. But so the Talmud says when they were dividing Eretz Yisrael among the various Shvatim, it doesn't make sense to draw the line between one Shevet and the other cutting through in the middle of a city. Ein cholkin mirachas l'shnei shvatim. You draw like the international dateline that we mentioned earlier. The nations of the world decide it doesn't make sense to draw the international dateline cutting through a continent. You're going to pose problems. On one side of the street it's going to be August 20th. The other side is going to be August 21st. It doesn't make any sense. They draw it, but it's not going to interfere with anybody. Draw it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean where there are no, there's no land mass over there. So the Talmud says the same with respect to dividing Eretz Yisrael l'shvatim. It doesn't make sense to draw the border to cut through a city, that half of the city belongs to one shevet, half of the city belongs to the other shevet. The one and only exception to the rule was Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim from day number one, in the days of Yishuv ben Nun, there was a city Yerushalayim. And it was divided, half was in Shevet Yehuda, and half was Shevet Binyamin. So Tosfos raises this question. How in the world did they do that? If the rabbis in the end of Sanhedrin had this position, that when they divided Eretz Yisrael l'shvatim, it doesn't make sense to draw the border through a city. So how did they bedafka divide Punkt Yerushalayim they divided into? So Tosfos explains they had to. The halacha required Yerushalayim had to be a divided city. Both parts belong to the Jews. It had to be a divided city because half of it had to be the Beis HaMikdash. Yerushalayim has to be the place where the Beis HaMikdash has to be built. And the other half has to be the capital of Eretz Yisrael. The capital of Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be in Shevet Yehuda because the official government is supposed to be a kingdom, a monarchy, not supposed to be a democracy. We're not holding by that yet, but that's what it's supposed to be, a monarchy. It's supposed to be a monarchy. The Melech is supposed to be a descendant from the Malchus Beis David. That's called the Melech HaMashiach. The Mashiach B'Shem and HaMishcha, the real Mashiach B'Shem and HaMishcha, is only the descendants from Malchus Beis David. And the other kings who were not descendants from Malchus Beis David only had imitation Mashiach. They didn't have real Mashiach B'Shem and HaMishcha. They had imitation Mashiach with Shem and HaFarsimon, which wasn't the Shem and Mishcha's Kodesh. So half of Yerushalayim has to be Bechelka Shal Yehuda because the government has to be from Shevet Yehuda. And the other half of Yerushalayim has to be Bechelka Shal Binyamin because Yankif Avinu and his Tzavoyah before he died, as well as Moshe Rabbeinu and his Nevuah before he died, the Brachas and the Zeis HaBracha, they both said that Beis HaMikdash will be built Bechelka Shal Binyamin. The Mizbeach has to be built Bechelka Shal Binyamin. So that's what the rabbis of the Talmud said. They had no choice. They had to divide Yerushalayim into two. The capital had to be Yerushalayim, and the Beis HaMikdash had to be Yerushalayim. And the half of Yerushalayim that was the capital had to be Bechelka Shal Yehuda, because the government has to be from Shevet Yehuda. And the half of Yerushalayim that's for the Beis HaMikdash had to be Bechelka Shal Binyamin. So there they had no choice. In fact, the Rambam has an interesting din, which he quotes in the Talmud Yerushalmi, that no king other than the Malchut Beis David, which is the official kingdom, is permitted to have his palace and his official offices in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is the official capital of Eretz Yisrael for the official government. That's why it's taka questionable. Is it permissible now for the Israeli government to use Yerushalayim as the capital? Maybe they're not allowed to. That's where some people joke that the American Congress didn't want the Israeli government to violate this din in the Rambam, so that's why they don't recognize Yerushalayim as the capital. Because the Rambam quotes such a din from the Talmud Yerushalmi that no kingdom, the Rambam doesn't say what's a din if it's not a kingdom, what's a din if it's a democracy. He says if you have a kingdom other than the Malchus Beis David, the official kingdom, Malchus Beis David is called the Malchus HaNevcheres, the Etcha B'David Abdi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in Tanakh, he chose the Malchus Beis David, he chose the descendants of David to be the Malchus HaNevcheres. So the Malchus HaNevcheres is the official government of Eretz Yisrael, and they are supposed to have their official government offices in Yerushalayim. And any other king, other than the Malchus HaNevcheres, is not permitted to use Yerushalayim as his capital. So this is Taka Halacha. Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be Eretz Yisrael, that has Kedusha, and it's the Mitzaref of all of Klal Yisrael, and so on and so forth. But also, Eretz Yisrael is supposed to have, it's supposed to have a Jewish government. It's supposed to be a Yiddish in Medina. Medina is Yisrael. And the capital of that Medina, the official capital of that Medina, is supposed to be Yerushalayim. We know from the Chumash in different places, that's in this week's Seder also in Parshas Metzora, we're going to read, you have another din that only applies in Eretz Yisrael for none of the above reasons. Ki savoyu el Eretz Kinan, there's an institution of Tzaraz Batim. That's a Pella, that's a miraculous thing. The Derech HaTeva absolutely doesn't make any sense at all. So the rabbis had a tradition that this was a nest that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows Bnei Yisrael because in Eretz Yisrael there's special Hashgacha Pratis. There's more Hashgacha Pratis in Eretz Yisrael than there is in Chutz Lorot. That's another aspect of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is the Eretz Hashereini Hashem Elokecha Bom Mereshis Hashon about Akrishon. There's more Hashgacha Pratis in Eretz Yisrael than in the rest of the world. This is unrelated to the fact that there is a Medina, no Medina. This was always the case. Even if there would be no Medina, this is still a fact. Eretz Yisrael has more Hashgacha Pratis than the rest of the world. We have a din in Shulchan Aruch that when giving tzedakah, we have priorities. We don't just a person is not a balabas. So if a person is a multimillionaire, he's not a balabas over his money to decide where he wants to give the charity. We consider everybody like an apotropos, as if I'm working for a foundation. I'm not a balabas to tailor the money to decide where I want to give the money. I'm just a secretary there. So even if I'm the rich man, I'm the wealthy person, I'm not the balabas to decide what to do with my money. There are halachas in the Shulchan Aruch. There are priorities. Where are you supposed to give your money? So one of the priorities is first you take care of family. If there are people in the family who are in need, so aniyei mishpachtachot take precedence to the aniyei other aniyim. Then aniyei yircha kodim laniyei yiracheres. Once a person, and then we have rules and regulations, what that means. It doesn't mean you don't give anything to the Yatayim. It means whenever there are priorities, that means you give two-thirds to the first level and one-third to the next level. And then there's another priority, so you give of whatever is left, you give two-thirds to this level and one-third to the next level. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Talmud, once you've already taken care of all of the local institutions, all the local anim, all the local needs, the local yeshivas and so on, the local mikveh, everything local, aniya yircha kodim laniya yiracheres, when you're taking care of others, not from the local tzarachim, so then the Talmud has a principle based on Sukkim and Chumash, aniya Eretz Yisrael, akodim laniya shamakimis. You have to take care of the poor in Eretz Yisrael. And all of the needs, not only the aniyim, the yeshivas, and the mikvahs, and everything in Eretz Yisrael, because we are all supposed to be living in Eretz Yisrael. So we're all officially, lemaisa, we're not living there, but officially we're all supposed to be citizens of Eretz Yisrael. So in a certain sense, we are all of Eretz Yisrael is really supposed to be our makom. And more so Yerushalayim, more so than the rest of Eretz Yisrael. So that's why it has been the practice for many, many centuries to take care, always to send tzedakah to Eretz Yisrael. In fact, this is very famous, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the whole founder of the whole Lubavitcher movement, Rabbi Schneerson, the one who authored the Tanya, was arrested and imprisoned several times because he used to raise money for the Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael at that time was controlled by the Turks. And the Turks were at war with the Russians, so they used to massa, the misnagdim used to massa to the Russian government that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is supporting the enemy. Was he supporting the enemy? He was sending money to the poor Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. So they said they massa that he's supporting the Turks. He's supporting the enemy in the war against the Russians. But this was always the practice. The Jews, the Hasidim and the misnagdim, they always used to take care of Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. And all of the tzarachim of Eretz Yisrael, the Chasam Sofer speaks about the importance of paying to pave highways in Eretz Yisrael, paying to build homes in Eretz Yisrael. First you have to pay, Yerushalayim takes precedence over the rest of Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael takes precedence over the rest of the world. Because in a certain sense we are all supposed to be citizens of Eretz Yisrael and treat Eretz Yisrael as if it's a local tzarach. Yom HaTzmaut is approaching, and many people don't fully understand what we're celebrating on Yom HaTzmaut. We're celebrating all of the above. We're celebrating the fact that we believe Eretz Yisrael always belonged to the Jewish people from day number one. It has nothing to do with the Balfour Declaration, with the United Nations, with the Mohammed HaShechrur. If there wouldn't have been a Mohammed HaShechrur, we wouldn't have gotten it Lamaisa. But after we got it, our position is that Eretz Yisrael always belonged to the Jews from the days of Avraham Avinu, and Eretz Yisrael is considered central in the Jewish religion, in the sense that Eretz Yisrael is the mitzaref of the Jewish people. Eretz Yisrael is considered our makom. We always supported the Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael. We always supported the Israeli institutions. Not something new that just began now after 1948. This was always the case. The Babi Rebbe was in the late 1700s. This, and before also, they always used to give sent docket to Eretz Yisrael. And the Rambam wrote already in his time. There were hardly any Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. There was just barely a minion of Jews. He says there's the 10 farmers who live in Eretz Yisrael, they constitute the Klal Yisrael. And all of the thousands and millions of Jews who live in Chutz Lortz, they're Jewish, they have a Kedush Yisrael that they don't have, but they're not considered Klal Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael always played a role in the Jewish religion, not only with respect to the mitzvahs HaTluyos Ba'aretz, that the agricultural mitzvahs only apply in Eretz Yisrael because it has the Kedush, even without the Kedush. Forget about the issue of the Kedush. Eretz Yisrael always played this central role, based on the Psukim in Tanakh. Thank you very much.
Thank you everyone for coming. We still have 14 games and in the table set up in case anybody would like to do the ceremony. We have a short
Thank you.